The truth is that politicians are ultimately accountable to the people. They want to keep their jobs, and they will follow where the people will lead. And even in countries where the vote or the ballot box doesn't seem to bring about change, people still have the power to peacefully protest and demand action. So imagine, if you will, even the most autocratic government cannot withstand 200,000 grandmothers peacefully blocking the streets and the seats of government. Okay, just imagine somebody gives an order to shoot, to kill, to the young soldiers, and there's a 20-year-old soldier, and a grandmother looks up at him and says, "Hey, son, come on, sit down, have some food, eat with me. You must be hungry. This is it's been a long day." So there's simply a point where human nature will just take over and will not allow that to happen. So think of this as a powerful image. We have shown in history that civil disobedience will bring about significant change. Remember Mahatma Gandhi in India? He led a non-violent resistance movement that eventually led to India's independence from Britain. And Britain at the time was the superpower of the world. So I firmly believe that if people understand the importance of a global union and demand it, then politicians absolutely have no choice but to follow.
Hello, everyone. Today's episode is not just another conversation. It's a deep dive into a transformative idea that could reshape our world. And isn't that what we're all yearning for? No one's satisfied with the state of the world as it is now. So in an age where global challenges seem insurmountable, we're about to explore a revolutionary, or should I perhaps say more evolved, approach that promises not just hope, which is absolutely crucial at this time, but a practical, common sense approach. Paint a picture of this, a world where the vast global complexity of issues are met with equally global solutions, all overseen by a unique assembly of visionaries, untouched by the usual partisan political games, commercialization, or market forces. To guide us through this vision, we're joined by someone who's seen the peaks of technological innovation and now dedicates his life to global betterment. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to Lars Graf. A Princeton-trained engineer, Lars was once a software entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. After a successful career, he took a turn towards a more global perspective, diving deep into development economics through a course or a program at the London School of Economics. This blend of tech prowess and global insight makes him a unique voice in today's conversation about solving the world's problems. Lars, welcome to the show.
David, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I understand that you're bucking the tide of conventional wisdom at this time by being optimistic about our future and believe we're on the cusp of a transition towards a global civilization. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. David, wherever I turn in the world, I hear people talking about the doom and gloom that's around them. There's talk about the climate, pandemics, war, refugees. You know the story. However, I find that there's nobody out there that's giving a clear, positive story about how we can actually move forward. Mm. And we need that to be okay. And I believe this is possible. While it's true that the world is facing numerous challenges, I believe that by applying a little bit of common sense and a broader perspective, we can actually see a path forward. And we are at a pivotal moment where we can transition to a global civilization that promises us a safer, more peaceful, more prosperous, and a sustainable future for all of us.
Now, you've highlighted three key points that everyone should realize. Will you walk us through them, Lars?
Certainly. First, global challenges require global solutions. And that requires a global union of all nations and effective institutions in that union. You see, we are all interconnected, and challenges like the climate or pandemics just don't stop at borders. Secondly, we need global policies with a long-term perspective, not just these 4 or 5 year democratic election cycles where every 4 or 5 years, you have complete policy change. We need at least a time horizon of 50 or more years. And this is essential for us to ensure sustainability in our life. And the third is the global union is actually achievable. Right now, we have seen global cooperation in the past, even if we didn't always recognize it as such. It's simply the next step in our social evolution as a human species.
Well, here you've proposed an innovative addition to the traditional three branches of modern government, a council as a fourth branch. Can you explain its role for us?
The council. So the council would be a fourth branch of government in the global union at the same level of a Supreme Court. And its primary role would be to ensure long-term planning for the safety and welfare of all future generations. And this has actually been promoted and tested. This aligns with the concept, the principle of seven generations, which has been practiced by the Iroquois Native American nation, where decisions are considered for the welfare of the next seven generations to come.
And that rings familiar for me because I come from upstate New York, which is the traditional home of the Iroquois nation. So, Lars, this all seems a bit overwhelming. When we mention global challenges, what's the scope we're looking at? Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Certainly, David. By global challenges, we are referring to those pressing issues that transcend national boundaries, but that still have repercussions for every corner in the world, for all of us. They aren't just concerns for one country or just a select group of countries. They're concerns for humanity as a whole. And these challenges are so vast and interconnected that no single nation, regardless of its power or influence in the world, can tackle them in isolation. So to address them effectively requires a united global effort. Mm-hmm. And we need to bring together the collective wisdom and the resource of all nations worldwide.
So, Lars, when we talk about global challenges, it seems there are two distinct categories. Can you shed some light on this?
Certainly. First, we have the challenges, global challenges we have already addressed and solved. So let's actually call them global solutions. And these are the ones that we have seamlessly integrated into our daily lives. And it's so much so that that we often completely overlook them. On the other hand, we have challenges that currently seem unsurmountable and daunting. And it's important that we recognize our successes in the past to create these global solutions, because that actually demonstrates to us the capacity for global cooperation and the creation of institutions that actually work. So by leveraging these established mechanisms, we really do have a blueprint for how to proceed and how to be successful at this.
Well, Lars, you've given us some examples of global solutions that have already been attempted and are almost universally familiar, which we've often overlooked and taken for granted. Can you cite some of those, please?
Certainly. I mean, they're not exciting unless you think we don't have them. So let's take safety and international travel. So I'm passionate about sailing. I'm right now training to skipper boats on open seas. Okay, and whether I'm in a small boat or a massive cruise ship, we all have to follow the same international rules. In addition, if there's an emergency like a fire on board, which is, you know, a very, very devastating sort of thing, okay, they're really agreed upon ways to signal for help and to notify folks of distress messages, and an aid will come no matter where we are in the world. So this is an example of how we cooperate. Let's take air travel. Imagine you're flying to Paris because you have an anniversary. So how chaotic would it be if our pilots didn't have ways to communicate to air traffic control in France because there are no agreements in place? And thank goodness we do have the standards for that to make these trips smooth and safe. Let's say you have a dream of working as a diplomat in the UN. Isn't it amazing that we have standards in international agreements that protect diplomats from unfair prosecution in foreign lands? I mean, this is really essential. This is the essence for how we do global diplomacy. Communications. Have you ever been abroad and wanted to call home or maybe send a quick message to a loved one? We have international tech standards that really make our phones and emails work seamlessly across borders. Or going back to the restaurant, you're in Paris, you're at this wonderful restaurant, and now you need to pay the bill. So you open your wallet and you pull out the plastic card that a US bank gave you and you hand it to the waiter, and it works. You don't have to wash dishes, okay? They take it and the money transfer happens out of your account. And this is really because there are global agreements on money transfer and currency conversion. A lot of people are talking about tax evasion, you know, for the billionaires in the world. Well, here's an interesting story. I currently live in a small eco-village in a small rural town in northern Germany. And did you know that even my small hometown bank is like a credit union, has to literally report any interest that I earn on a savings account to the United States IRS. And this is really all part of the agreements to ensure that there's a fair global taxation. Also, if somebody commits a crime in one country, he can, in many countries, be tracked and arrested in another country and brought back for prosecution. So in essence, these are global solutions, many of which we just take for granted in this interconnected world that function smoothly. Okay, and they're sort of it's called the unsung heroes of our modern life.
Well, Lars, when we talk about global challenges, what are the pressing issues at this time that come to your mind?
Well, David, there are a few. So let's dive into them. There's climate dynamics, or let me actually call it climate destabilization, because that's really what's happening. Our climate is destabilizing. So in our changing world, temperatures rise and ocean currents shift. Okay, and we're witnessing an unprecedented environmental changes. And it's not really just one country's problems. It's really everybody's.
This is true. Absolutely. It's everyone's responsibility. And it's not just the environment, right?
No, you have other things. For example, you have massive concerns about migration waves. So there are conflicts. There's tremendous economic disparity. There are environmental changes that are driving people away from their homes. And that are creating a global migration crisis.
And with the meteoric rise of technology, there are new challenges in that field as well.
Spot on, David. So there's the whole puzzle about artificial intelligence. And this is a really big one. Okay, the power of AI to influence human decisions and reshape political landscapes is a marvel, but it's also really scary. Okay, and that's not even touching on the potential economic transformations that are taking place in many, many industries and the potential for significant job shifts. So how do we deal together as a community with AI safety?
And it's not just a concern. It can be downright aggravating. I was working with a musician and he was using me as a lyricist, and he decided to use AI instead of my skills. And that was rather alarming. And of course, once I read it, AI stuff wasn't as good as mine. So I think the true artists and the real economists and so on throughout the world will win over AI in the end. AI will be our friend and our tool, but not our master. So health is also a global concern, especially after recent events.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the incredible stress that environmental pollution is putting on the immune systems of mankind.
Yeah, let's look at pandemic preparedness. Okay, it's crucial. You know, we're in an internet-connected world. So diseases can spread rapidly with international air traffic within a day or two. And we need to be able to have effective global health collaboration, which we have seen the need for in the past 3 years. And then there's concerns like the proliferation of mass destruction, not just by powerful states, but into the hands of non-state actors. Okay, so for example, in biosecurity, you know, it's very soon that, you know, high schoolers will be able to do gene modifications where you send in a gene sequence you want and you get a biological samples back, okay? They are so close. And these kind of things we really have to work together on.
And 50 years ago, this whole threat was completely unknown. It was just a subject for science fiction. And so we've been in the digital age for some time now, and I assume that brings its own set of challenges?
Absolutely, David. Cyber resilience is key. So we have become so incredibly dependent on digital interconnection for our global infrastructure that we have to safeguard it from cyber threats. And let's not forget about preserving our planet, you know, with the loss of rainforests, biodiversity, and the changes in our water cycle. Plus, there's taxation in the digital age. So what does it mean to tax somebody in the age of the blockchain? Where does income get generated? Who owns the asset? Where is the asset based? In what country? So all of these things, they require collaboration.
Yes, and it seems clear, Lars, that these challenges underscore the importance of global unity and cooperation.
Absolutely. Only by joining forces can we really hope to address these issues. And we really do need to do this sooner than later.
So, Lars, I understand that global challenges require a global union. But just what do you mean by effective global institutions?
Great question, David. When I talk about effective global institutions, I'm referring to those bodies and organizations that have the authority and the resources and also the mandate to address these global challenges. You see, it's not just about having a group and a name and some press releases, okay? It's about having institutions that can genuinely make decisions and implement those solutions, not just come up with things that have to be done, but actually make it happen. And this requires compliance across many, many nations. Think of it this way. In our daily lives, we have police departments and courts and governments locally, and they really ensure the safety and justice and sort of our well-being on a local level. But on a global scale, we need similar structures that are designed to tackle these challenges that cross borders.
So we're talking about more than just discussions and agreements, but enforcement as well, right?
Yeah, precisely. Discussions and agreements are really, really wonderful. We can talk all about limiting carbon emission or whatever we want to talk about and pat ourselves on the back that we have signed resolutions that we want to do this. Okay, but if they lack enforceability, they are useless. So effective global institutions would have mechanisms to ensure that decisions are not just made, but are also implemented. And it's about having the tools and the authority to act, and also the transparency to be held accountable. So when a decision gets made, it has to be taken into action. But if these actions are not correct, there has to be a review on a democratic basis openly for why these decisions are made and whether they are correct.
And I assume these institutions overseeing compliance would not be autocratic, but rather democratic in nature?
Ideally, yes. They really need to represent the interests of all nations and the people. And that assures that these decisions are made for the collective good and not just for a few nations that happen to be in a particular special role of influence and power. Okay? It's about creating a system where every nation, big or small, has a voice and a stake in the global future of our world.
And Lars, you've mentioned the need for effective global institutions, but don't we have already several international bodies doing that work?
Yes, absolutely, David. Indeed, we have many institutions that actually function remarkably well. So, for example, we have the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO. Anybody ever heard of this? And they are the ones that assure the flights, like make sure that your flight for your anniversary to Paris works and it goes safely. We have the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, and that's another example. So they make sure through their standards that our phones and emails work seamlessly worldwide. And so they are so embedded in our daily lives that we just take them for granted. But, you know, they're really, if you think about it, they're really shining examples of what's possible when nations collaborate for a common good or a common benefit.
Right. And I remember you mentioning how even in financial transactions, like using a credit card abroad or transferring money, there are global standards already in place.
Yeah. So there are some institutions that facilitate those processes really rather smoothly. But others, like the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, or the World Bank, have often faced criticism in the past. They have been accused of easily being influenced and controlled by a few powerful nations. And that completely changes the way that they can really achieve the objective that they were originally being created for, at least if they were being created for the common good.
Yes, some of these existing international organizations, as well as some of the larger wealthier countries like the United States, have sometimes offered or sometimes even coerced poorer countries into accepting loans with high interest rates. And those poor countries end up paying more to the loaner country in interest than they received in the original loan. And what about institutions, for instance, like the United Nations or the World Trade Organization? They've been around for a while, but many argue that they aren't as effective as they should be.
You're spot on, David. The United Nations, for example, really emerged in the aftermath of World War II. And if you think about it, this wasn't attempt number two. It actually succeeded the League of Nations, which was created after World War I by Woodrow Wilson. So the UN has achieved a lot, but it also faced significant challenges. And one of the main issues with the UN, especially with the Security Council, is the veto power held by the five permanent member nations. And this veto power often hampers really swift and collective action and decision-making, And in addition, the UN has practically no enforcement powers. So if you look at bodies like the World Trade Organization, they often get criticized for similar reasons, whereas they should be a platform for global smoothing out of commerce and trade, which is actually very beneficial to many nations. Instead, they're being used for often for exerting control and power and in the level of hegemony. Okay, so we really got to look carefully at what institutions work and what don't.
Yes, and in reference to the UN, which you mentioned, there is nothing quite so undemocratic as the veto, which the Security Council members still possess, and which in part has made the Security Council obsolete. It was useful after World War II, but has outlived its usefulness and is actually a hindrance to global justice at this point. So the issue isn't the concept of global institutions, but how they're structured and function.
Precisely. Okay. So the idea is to learn from what is working, for example, travel, communications, and funds transfers, and to reform or throw away what's not, for example, security councils with the veto of a limited number of member nations. So we need these institutions to be truly representative, truly transparent, and they need to be immune to undue influence, even from our own country, the United States. And we need to ensure this, that they really work for all and not just for select few nations. And this is really important. Only this way will individual nations agree to delegate some amount of their sovereign decision-making to a global union to solve these challenges, the global challenges we absolutely have to solve. And see, it has to be trusted and fair to all, or it will just not work.
Yes, here in the U.S., there are many citizens who seem to take a dim view of the UN for whatever reason. And thankfully, the UN is in New York City. Were it in another country, the U.S. may well have done its best to ignore it and shirk its responsibilities to the UN. So, Lars, when you talk about the global union, how do you envision its structure?
The global union should be built on a robust foundation based on the best practices of governance that we have seen throughout history. And at its core, it should have the standard three branches of government that we have come to know. The first one is the executive branch, and this will be responsible for implementing and enforcing laws and policies set by the legislative branch. And it would oversee the day-to-day business and operation of the global union. We're very familiar with this. The second is the legislative branch. And there I envision a bicameral system where we have two chambers, just like in the United States, the House of Representatives, the Senate. One chamber would represent the populations of the member nations, and that representation is based on the population size. And the other chamber, just like the Senate in the United States, would have an equal representation for each member nation, and that ensures that even smaller countries have an equal voice in this legislative process. And this dual system ensures that there's fairness and balance, and it has worked pretty well over the past hundreds of years in actually quite many countries. The third branch is the judicial branch, and this is where courts interpret the laws and make sure that they are justly applied. Okay, and this what's really important: the courts also serve as a checks and balances on the other branches of governments, and so that they can handle disputes also among member nations.
And the fourth branch, Lars, would be the Council, of which you have spoken.
Yeah, so the Council is really a key innovation in the global union. Okay, as mentioned before, we need long-term planning. It is just not enough to have four-year election cycles and constant policy changes, because no politician that has to stand for election in another 4 years will make decisions that are painful now, but have really a meaningful benefit in the long run. Okay, so this council would be the body of long-term thinkers, free from immediate pressures of politics and commerce, and this can be done. And its members would be appointed for extended terms, not just 4 years, but let's say at least 20 years. And that will assure continuity and a long-term focus. So this council should be made up of experts like, for example, Nobel laureates, philosophers, leading thinkers from various fields. And the council's primary role would be to plan for the long term, to address those challenges that really span decades or centuries, which really cannot be addressed in our 4-year election cycles.
So the decisions of the council will not be sullied by an involvement in day-to-day politics.
No, precisely. The council's scope would be very, very restricted to focusing solely on long-term issues that affect all of humanity. It wouldn't be mired in day-to-day politics or short-term challenges. And here's the crucial part. The decisions of the council would be binding, and they would hold the same weight as the constitution of the global union itself. So there shouldn't be many decisions, but when they are made, they have constitutional weight. Okay? And this assures that the long-term vision set by the council isn't just inspirational, but it is really acted upon.
Hmm. And Lars, how would these binding decisions play out in practice, particularly with those countries that don't want to cooperate?
Well, let's first look inside the council, inside the global union. So when a decision is made, for example, imagine an amendment to the constitution has been made. At that point, the amendment has to be implemented by the executive branch and the legislative branches. Okay. So, for example, if the we're not talking about constitutional amendment, but it's the same level. This is an analogy. So, for instance, if the council mandates a specific long-term environmental policy, then the executive branch would be responsible for implementing it. And the legislator would be responsible for enacting the necessary laws to do this. And if these branches of government fail to act, then according to the council's mandates, then they can be taken to the Supreme Court and sued, just like any other constitutional challenger. Okay? And the court can then compel the executive and legislative branch to act within the council's decision, ensuring that the long-term vision is not just a recommendation, but it's a directive that must be followed. And we have, like in Europe, we actually have similar mechanisms in place where the European Union can demand individual states to implement certain laws, and they can also then be cross-checked by the European court. So this has all been done. This is not anything totally unusual.
It sounds like an evolutionary step up in terms of global thought and governance. So Lars, with such a powerful entity as the Council, how do we ensure it doesn't overstep its boundaries?
David, that's really a fundamental concern. Okay, the Council has a significant role in shaping our long-term vision, and it's absolutely essential to have checks and balances, just like we have in the other three branches of government. So the primary check on the Council is the Supreme Court itself. If the council makes a decision and there is a belief that it has overstepped its constitutional mandate, then that decision can be challenged in the Supreme Court. And the court then has the authority to review the decision. And if it finds that the council has indeed exceeded its mandate, it can overrule the council's decision. So this system ensures that while the council has the authority to make binding decisions for the long-term good of all of humanity, it also remains within the confines of its defined constitutional role.
Lars, some people, particularly here in the U.S., might be worried about the concept of world government. They might see it as a threat to national sovereignty or cultural identity. How would you respond to such concerns?
David, that's a very valid concern. The idea of a global union is not to create a world government that overrides national and local governments. It's about creating a structure that allows us to effectively deal with issues that are truly global in nature. Think of it as a federated system, similar to what we have in countries like United States or Germany. In these countries, there is a clear division of responsibilities between the federal government and the states. The federal government handles issues that affect the entire country, such as national defense, foreign policy, or interstate commerce. Meanwhile, the states have the power to regulate local matters, such as education, public health, or local law enforcement. So the global union would operate on a similar principle. Its mandate would be limited to those issues and only those issues that require global cooperation. And so such as climate change or global pandemics or international trade or peacekeeping. It would not interfere in matters of national or local concerns, such as cultural, religious, or social issues. So because these need to remain in the purview of the national and the local governments. In other words, the global union is not just about creating a one-size-fits-all global government. It's about creating a framework for global cooperation on issues that affect all of us. And this has to be done while respecting the sovereignty and cultural diversity of the individual nations. It's about finding the right balance between global governance and national autonomy. And again, we have seen this many times before at slightly lower levels.
And aren't the many existing global institutions effectively already a form of global governance?
Absolutely, David. We already have a form of global governance in place right now. Okay? We have numerous international institutions and agreements that govern many, many areas of our lives for better. And it's these institutions that have been instrumental in fostering cooperation among nations and addressing issues that transcend national boundaries. However, there's some institutions that are just not as effective as they could be. So for instance, the United Nations, it really has struggled to adapt to the changing dynamics of the 21st century. Its structure, particularly again, the veto power held by the five permanent member nations in the Security Council, just often hampers its ability to act decisively on global issues because always somebody there who doesn't like the decision. Okay, so when we talk about a global union, we're not talking about something that is created entirely from scratch. Rather, we're talking about building on what we have already created and just making it work better. We're talking about updating and upgrading our existing structures of global governance to just make them more effective, to make them more democratic, to make them more responsive to the 21st century challenges, not just the 20th century challenges. We're talking about creating a system of global governance that really works for everyone and not just for a select few. So it's just the next step in our social evolution. Also, we need to realize we have been on this path of social evolution for thousands of years, moving from small tribes to city-states to individual nations to regional unions and to even what I call super-regional states. So take, for example, the European Union or the United States, which is essentially a federation of 50 individual states. We also have the African Union, and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and many others. And these are all examples of how we have been gradually building larger and more complex structures in which we as human beings cooperate and create more cohesive governance.
Well, Lars, this whole global union sounds like a massive undertaking. Who's going to pay for it?
Financing a global union would indeed be a significant task. But it's not as daunting as it might seem at first glance. The key is to think about it in terms of shared responsibilities and shared benefits. One way to finance the global union would be through contributions from member nations as a percentage of their gross domestic product, the GDP. And this is a common approach used by other international organizations today. So for instance, NATO. NATO member nations are expected to contribute 2% of their GDP towards common defense. Now, this doesn't mean that they have to, you know, do money transfer to some common entity of 2% of their budget. It means that the spending that they're doing for defense has to be within their own boundaries, 2% of the gross domestic product. Okay. Similarly, the global union could be expect member nations to contribute, let's say, 5% of the GDP towards common goals. Some of it needs to be transferred for administrative purposes, but some of it may also come out of the industry and the spending towards the common goals by the individual countries. It can actually be an accounting issue, similar to the way it's done at NATO. So now some might argue this is a lot of money, but it's important to remember that this is not just an expense, it's an investment in our shared future. And by pooling our resources and by working together, we can actually tackle global challenges more effectively. And to do this really more efficiently than any one nation can do on its own. Moreover, the global union would lead to significant savings in other areas. So, for example, by promoting peace and stability, it would reduce the need for military spending. So currently, nations around the world literally spend trillions of dollars each year on defense. And even a small reduction in these expenses would free up substantial resources for other purposes. And lastly, we have to consider the cost of inaction. So the challenges we face today, from climate change to pandemics to global conflicts, carry enormous costs. By working together through the global union, we can mitigate these risks and avoid these astronomical costs associated with these global disasters. So while financing the global union would require a significant commitment, it also is the most cost-effective way for us to go forward. It is an investment in our shared future, and it really is an investment that we can't afford not to make. We really don't have a choice in the end. But please allow me to make one more additional comment here. This approach would also help us to avoid the undue influence of private funding on global institutions, which we have seen in the past. While private funding and philanthropy has an important role to play in addressing global challenges, they should not be the primary source of funding for global institutions. We have seen this in the past, where the priorities of private donors have shaped the agenda of international organizations. And this undermines the credibility of these institutions and really is not in our global best interest.
And we in the States have certainly had a serious problem on that score, where we've been saddled since the late 1940s with what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. So perhaps now we can turn this equation on its head and start spending more of that money on basic human rights, like proper food, housing, healthcare, education, those issues coming first and defense coming last, especially since we'll be working with our brethren around the world, sharing defense responsibilities. So Lars, how would the global union deal with the freeloader problem? That is, nations that benefit from the union's actions, but do not participate enough or contribute their fair share.
Before I address the freeloader problem, let me just go step back one step. Yes, we have tremendous amount of interest by military and the military commercial complex. Okay, but you have to understand, even arms manufacturers don't really care about manufacturing weapons. What they care about is making money. Mm. Okay, so instead of having them build tanks, let them build something that is more useful for all of us. You know, it's the classic guns into plowshares argument. So I have absolutely no problem feeding these industries money, but let's make it for something that is meaningful and useful and not just for destructive efforts. And they will be very, very happy to take it. And if you have long-term policies where they can see that this actually works, they will actually move their business towards that. And there's definitely a way to go. All you have to do corporation is feed them the money, which we're already spending. So it's not a loss. Let's just direct it in a way that really serves us. Now, let me go back to the freeloader problem. This is a problem that is a common challenge in any collective effort. Okay. However, there are effective mechanisms to address this. So when many countries or many people get together, but everybody, even the ones who do not participate, get a benefit, then there's always the interest of, hey, let me not actually participate, but still receive the benefit. Okay. So firstly, when countries do not participate in the global union, we can impose import and export taxes on them. Okay, so this would incentivize them to either join the union and to contribute their fair share, or if they, for political reasons, don't want to really join, but they still want to reap the benefits, it's a form of for them to pay and make a contribution to it. So if they benefit from global stability and the prosperity fostered by the global union, it's really only fair that they contribute to it. Secondly, there are sanctions. So if a government or an institution or a government does not want to participate and actively works against the policies and the decisions that are made by the global union, then sanctions can be applied. Okay, and we have a long history of doing that and influencing national behavior. So, for example, we have seen how the international community has isolated Russia in response to the attacks on the Ukraine. And lastly, when the global security is at stake, police or military action can be considered. And this, of course, should be the last resort and would require a collective decision by the global union. However, think of it this way. There was a time in the 1960s where the minority rights in the United States were at a local and state levels, were trampled and were not regarded, even though there were federal laws in place. And even if a local sheriff or a local mayor or county or local state governor chose to ignore federal law, there would be court decisions and warrants, and the FBI, the federal police, could step in and can hold these people accountable. So if a country is actively pursuing hostile actions, there is a way, think of it as a global police force, to step in and to hold that country responsible. So none of these mechanisms is really new. And they have been effectively used by nations like the United States over the past 70 years, and more recently, China in its Silk Road Initiative. The key is to apply these mechanisms in a fair and transparent manner, with the goal of fostering that global cooperation and that shared responsibility.
Lars, I'm glad you laid out how that can all work equitably, because sometimes in the past, actions like boycotts and sanctions can be a blunt instrument hurting the most vulnerable groups in the target country. So Lars, what if some countries, let's say China, for instance, don't want to participate in the global union? What then?
You know, actually, I believe China is likely to participate. And that's as long as the global union doesn't interfere with China and how it governs its own people. And I think they would see the benefit of joining. Okay. So there are some issues like human rights, which are things that are very important to me, or even the Taiwan issue, which might need to be deferred in favor of truly global challenges. We have seen this in the formation of the United States. The United States Constitution did not include a prohibition against slavery at the founding of the country. This had to be dealt with much, much later, because the states, the southern and northern states, would have never gotten together to form the union, the United States. We need to focus on really what's important. These are the global challenge, as much as we care about human rights and other issues. We need to defer some of those to the countries, and hopefully over time they can be addressed. China would most likely see the participation in the global union as a further way to expand its global reach and influence. They have been very much striving for that. See, one of the things we have to understand, China's economy is deeply intertwined with the global economy. And they absolutely heavily rely on imports for energy, oil, and gas. And they rely in the economy for the exports of their products. So at the moment, the United States is the security guarantor for the global, for the world, and has been for the past 70 years. And it actually assures that shipping, this may sound really mundane, but it's very important. If there's no guarantees that tankers and ocean lighters and container ships can go from one country to the other, and for it to be safe, where there's no piracy or where they don't get captured. Okay, if that cannot be guaranteed, then global commerce is impossible. And if energy transfer, energy purchases by China do not happen, then this will have devastating consequences on China's economy. And the country may literally fail. I mean, the country, China's already at a very, very shuddering state where the economy will fail. And if that happens, then the Chinese Communist Party would also fail. So we need to work together. And I think China has a tremendous interest in doing that to ensure that global shipping and commerce would be secured. And most likely, I would see, in addition to the United States, to the extent they want to participate, that Britain, France, Japan, and China itself would participate. So I really see that the global union and the global collaboration is really essential for China. Interestingly enough, I see the growing isolationist movement and policies, especially in the past 8 years in the United States, as a greater problem. See, the U.S. might resist joining or demand special rights and exclusions from those rules. However, I believe in the end, the U.S. will join, especially if China does, because the cost of maintaining global peace would then be shared among many member nations in the global community, and this would relieve some significant burden from the United States. So to actually make these things happen, there will be a tremendous amount of diplomatic bargaining. Okay? But I can approximately see. So the United States currently has, with the US dollar, the reserve currency, which means that de facto the government can do unlimited indebtedness and unlimited spending because there are always more people that want the US dollar. Okay, so that reserve currency is currently being challenged by many nations, the BRICS states, Russia, Brazil, India, China. So if the global union were to offer the United States the deal that for a few more decades the US dollar would be the agreed upon reserve currency for the world, which again would allow pretty much unlimited deficit spending, this would allow the US to really buy some more domestic peace and tranquility. So I believe even for the United States, the commercial benefits of joining the global union would really be sufficient for them to join.
And Lars, you've mentioned the importance of a positive narrative. But what about the rise of nationalism we've seen around the world? Brexit, for instance, and other right-leaning trends in many countries. Aren't these signs of the people's desperation to the point where they're even voting against their own best interests?
David, you're absolutely right. These trends indeed are signs of desperation. People are feeling lost. They're feeling left behind, and they're really looking for solutions. Unfortunately, in the desperation, they're often drawn to simplistic national narratives with promises for easy solutions, but they just won't work. Okay, you cannot solve global issues with nationalism and isolation in your own country. So there really is only one narrative, which is that of us working together. And we need to use this desperation as a sign for people to change and for them to move forward. And this is exactly what the Global Union offers. The Global Union is not about taking away national sovereignty or erasing cultural identities. It's about cooperation. It's about working together to tackle global challenges that no single nation can solve on its own. It's about creating a better, more secure future for everyone. And the beautiful thing is, this kind of international cooperation doesn't just solve global challenges. It also makes people's day-to-day lives better. It leads to more stable economies, more peace, more secure jobs, a cleaner environment. So, yes, people are desperate for change, but the change they need is not a retreat into nationalism or a return into a world of over 100 years ago. It's a step forward into the 21st century and a more cooperative world and integrated world for all of us. But is it, please envision a world governed by a deep sense of equality and fairness, where transparency and the rule of law reign supreme. And it's not just merely a playground for commercial or private interests. And that's exactly what the Global Union offers.
And it sounds as if the world is ready for it, exhausted as we all are after centuries of war. So if we look back, Thomas Paine's simple pamphlet entitled Common Sense was simple, yet it had a profound impact on the American colonists at the time. And it made a compelling argument for American independence from British rule. And that seemed to resonate with the common people of the colonies. It helped spark a revolution and led to the birth of a new nation. Similarly, your ideas for a global union, while simple, have the potential to revolutionize how we approach and solve global challenges. It could be the equivalent of that common sense pamphlet of the 18th century. It could be the common sense of the 21st century, guiding us towards a more united, cooperative, and prosperous world.
Yeah, I appreciate that comparison. Like Thomas Paine, I believe in the power of ideas and the potential for change. You know, as you said, we really need a common sense for the 21st century. And that's, you know, for our globalized world. And I hope the concept of the global union can be the guiding light, can be the direction towards that.
So Lars, what if politicians in our own countries resist this idea? They might have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. How do we deal with that?
Well, David, that's a great question. The truth is that politicians are ultimately accountable to the people. They want to keep their jobs, and they will follow where the people will lead. And even in countries where the vote or the ballot box doesn't seem to bring about change, people still have the power to peacefully protest and demand actions. So imagine, if you will, even the most autocratic government cannot withstand 200,000 grandmothers peacefully blocking the streets and the seats of government. Okay, just imagine somebody gives an order to shoot, to kill, to the young soldiers, and there's a 20-year-old soldier, and a grandmother looks up at him and says, "Hey, son, come on, sit down, have some food, eat with me. You must be hungry. It's been a long day." So there's simply a point where human nature will just take over and will not allow that to happen. So think of this as a powerful image, we have shown in history that civil disobedience will bring about significant change. Mahatma Gandhi in India, he led a non-violent resistance movement that eventually led to India's independence from Britain. And Britain at the time was the superpower of the world. So I firmly believe that if people understand the importance of a global union and demand it, then politicians absolutely have no choice but to follow.
And when you mentioned the grandmothers, Lars, you remind me of the Chilean mothers who mourned their disappeared loved ones, disappeared by the government at the time, by dancing alone, just holding their photos, since dissent had been outlawed and silenced in that country. And if they had spoken aloud, they may have been arrested as well. And this eventually helped lead to justice and democracy for Chile. So people power is indeed the new world superpower. And in that sense, Lars, I get the sense that you are very positive about our future.
Yes, David. I believe we're living in transformative times. If we look back just over 100 years ago, Germany and France were throwing mustard gas canisters over each other's borders to poison each other in World War I. So fast forward to modern times. And now we are collaboratively negotiating on who pays for what bank bailout in the European Union, okay? This is a shift that 100 years ago, nobody could have imagined. This is a real leap in our human civilization. So today, despite what social media may tell us, we are in one of the most peaceful periods in human history. Moreover, we have witnessed remarkable progress in overall human well-being. Over the past 25 years, over 1 billion people have been lifted out of extreme poverty. And we've had amazing advances in medical science that have reduced child mortality. We have nearly eradicated polio. Fewer people, especially children, die of malaria, and fewer women die in childbirth. More children, and especially girls, are going to school than ever before. Yes, I believe if we work together, and we can all have a future that will exceed our wildest expectations.
I like those examples you brought up, Lars, and the more positive developments occurring today are not often enough covered by what someone wiser than I had called the hysterical news media that loves only a crisis. So today we've had a fascinating discussion with Lars Graf, who has presented a compelling vision for our global future. So Lars, can you give us just a quick summary of the key points that you've touched upon in your talk?
Certainly, David. First, global challenges require global solutions, and this has to be implemented in a global union where all nations participate with institutions that work and that are functional. Secondly, we need long-term planning to ensure a sustainable future. And this can be handled by a council made up of thinkers and leaders that is part of the fourth branch of government. And the third point is all of this is achievable because we have done it all in bits and pieces before. We just have to put it together.
This conversation has given us a lot to think about. It's clear that the challenges we face are complex, but with innovative and global cooperation, I think we can create a sustainable and equitable future for all. At least I think so. What do you think? You can let us know here at Planetary Makeover. Thank you, Lars, for being a guest today. And we hope to have you back on the show.
It will be my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And everyone, goodbye for now. See you back here again at Planetary Makeover. Visit us on Facebook at #PlanetaryMakeover. This show has been a production of PlanetaryMakeover.org.
We invite you to visit Planetary Makeover on YouTube, where we have dozens of fascinating shows in line with what you've just seen.